Hello, everybody. This is Scott Yates, Director of Communications and Producer Relations for the Washington Grain Commission, releasing episode 105 of Wheat All About It on Christmas Day. My gift to you, oh faithful podcast listeners. A few years ago, while I was still in the podcast dabbling stage, I was told unless you have a weekly podcast, you're wasting your time. It was this person's belief that a weekly schedule was necessary to build an audience. And I agree. As a result, for the last 2 years, there has been a new Wheat All About It podcast released every Tuesday. Just so happens that today, December 25th, is a Tuesday, although I'm preparing the podcast well in advance of that date. I don't suppose I'll be getting a lot of listeners over the Christmas holiday, but I'm a creature of deadlines. It's Tuesday. This podcast must go through. Yes, even when Tuesday's a Christmas day. Anticipating the release schedule, I was looking for a seasonal tie-in, which is why I wound up recording ARS scientist Kim Campbell and WSU scientist Karen Sanguinet on November 27th, talking to them about what's happening to the wheat plants during our cold season. If you listen to the first half, you know there's a lot of misconceptions about what exactly wheat is doing during the winter. In part two of the episode I've entitled, Dead of Winter, Alive with Life, Wheat Plants in the Cold, we step further into the weeds to learn how cold kills wheat, that big is not better in the cold, and how the cold acts as a brake. But first, in part one, Campbell talked a little about the meristems, a part of the wheat plant crown. They are a unique feature of wheat plants and act much as stem cells do in humans, meaning they can turn into any part of the wheat plant. Given that they are so significant, and I didn't know anything about them, I asked Sanguinet to go into more detail. Campbell's voice comes in around the two-minute mark.
So the meristems are buried deep inside the crown. There are several different meristems within a plant. There's the shoot apical meristem and the root apical meristem and then axillary meristems. So the meristems themselves are very small, tiny cells. They're cytoplasmically rich. They divide at very slow rates. And changes in hormone flux determine which cells are meristematic or and which aren't. So
they're sort of like stem cells.
Yeah, they give rise to all the organs. So they go through a differentiation process. So all organs are essentially initiated on the flanks of that meristem. So what can happen, and what Kim's referring to, is that meristem can be active, can initiate new organs, new leaves, for example. But then if that meristem is killed because the temperature gets too cold, those organs, those leaves are still initiated and you still see some growth, but then they're dead. That's why when we do drought tests or cold tests, we wait for a couple of weeks and we look, is it true recovery or is the meristem kaput?
Interesting. So it's dead, but it's still growing.
Yeah.
Well, the meristem has been killed, and meristem maintenance is a crucial driver of above ground and below ground development. The reason why Darwin called the root the brain of the plant is that you can obliterate a root meristem and get regeneration, de novo generation of another meristem at a lateral root site. It's more developmentally plastic than say the shoot, for example. But it depends on your root system. So there are differences between say canola or a taprooted system versus a fibrous root system like wheat. The wheat root system is highly fibrous, very extensive, very deep, and you can get partial kill of the root system and the wheat plant can still be fine.
Does the cold kill the plant by rupturing the plant cells?
The responses to cold and to dehydration are very similar, and it's because the cold is causing the fluidity of the cells to stop or to be limited. and the membranes aren't functioning right. You know, they're getting more and more solid. And cells really need their membranes to function right. A lot happens going through the membranes. And the first response that plants have is to do what they can to increase the fluidity of the membranes. And that's what Karen was talking about with the olive oil and butter analogy with the unsaturated acids. But then it gets to a point where it doesn't have the mechanism anymore to keep those membranes fluid because it's just getting too cold and too solid. And the water is kind of being lost from the cells, too, at the same time. And then ice crystals start to form. And once ice crystals start to form, they're jagged and they just rip things apart. And the plants are trying to produce sugars that will not allow those ice crystals to form. And it's a lot like antifreeze. That's the same thing we do with antifreeze is we try and put that fluid into our gasoline so it can't freeze up. But it just finally gets to the point where it's done everything it can and it can't. There isn't any more it can do. So
much going on. It's just amazing. I never knew.
What happens actually, and for a plant to be turgid and to stand upright, it's the pressure and the force between the plasma membrane and the cell wall that generates that turgor pressure for it to be erect. That membrane will plasmolyze or break because of an ice crystal formation. So it will come away from the cell wall, and there'll be a disassociation between the plasma membrane and the cell wall, and you'll get plasmolysis and electrolyte leakage. So we measure damage to cold based on electrolyte leakage, and it's also called water soaking. So you see a change in color of the leaf, and it typically goes from bright green to kind of a darker green, and you can see that water soaking spreading, and you can measure that physiologically, the amount of electrolyte leakage from a cell in response to cold. So you can have patches of death or different parts of the leaf that die back and necrose. It doesn't necessarily happen uniformly across the leaf.
I've always been surprised that a plant can be too big going into the winter, that, you know, you don't want them too big. Why is that? You would think that a bigger plant is a stronger plant.
I think that the reason why is just because the roots then have more to maintain. For a plant going into the winter, we were talking about how it's all growing slower. But really what the plant has had to be able to do is use the root system to get as much water into the and nutrients into the plant, and then also use the little tiny leaves to get as much photosynthate into the plant. So it has all these sugars we've been talking about kind of stored up to get through the winter. And if the plant gets too big, while it's been able to produce a little bit more of that, there's also just more to maintain, you know, this whole big structure on top. And it can kind of be too much for the root system to handle it and for its reserves to be able to handle it. So there's kind of an optimal size.
And what would that optimal size be?
I knew you were going to ask me that.
I mean, it's all about resource allocation,
right,
essentially.
Yeah.
So, you know, if you spend a lot of energy growing, and as Kim said, you have this very large structure, if you only have a few inches of snow and your plant is 6 inches tall, you only have 2 inches of insulating power from that snow. And then you have another 4 inches above that of plant material and tissue that's subject to wind and adverse weather conditions and so on and so forth.
From a researcher's point of view, I mean, you've both been doing this for a number of years. Do you believe our winters are getting warmer? Mm-hmm. Now, I ask that question because we haven't had widespread winter kill since 1991. And when I first started to work in agriculture, it was considered a once every 7 or 10 year occurrence.
Mm-hmm. The frost-free period length has increased. I just looked this up. It's increased about 18 days in the Pacific Northwest since 1980. So it's kind of follows that our winters are probably getting a little warmer. The issue is that there's more fluctuation and more variability in the winter. And also there can be less snow cover then too when you get a warmer winter. So I don't think it follows that necessarily that the reason why we've seen less winter kill is because the winters are getting a little warmer. But because we do get winter kill every year somewhere. It's just not as widespread as it was in 91. That occurrence in 91 was a really famous, horrible one.
Yes. But,
when I first got here, we were still talking about it. I actually think that winter kill that we got 2015, it was actually around this time of year, I think right around November 27th or 28th, killed a lot of plants before they were fully acclimated for the winter. That was widespread throughout the whole western U.S., actually, because it hit Colorado, Montana, and everywhere. So we still do get some major changes that happen in big ways. Mm-hmm. But I think our challenge is to try and figure out how to breed wheat to handle these temperature fluctuations, which do seem to be a little more dramatic than they were.
You've been working on cold-tolerant varieties of wheat for a number of years. Is the wheat that we have now, for instance, more cold-tolerant than, say, Eltan, which was released in 1992?
It's not more cold-tolerant than Eltan, because Eltan is quite good. We have more wheat that's more similar to Eltan than we did. And especially coming out of the WSU winter wheat breeding program, most of that material is quite winter tolerant. When Eltan was released, it was kind of unique for being as winter tolerant as it is, but a lot of the material coming out of that breeding program is similar to Eltan now. My breeding program, we've certainly increased the winter tolerance of the clubs. And then there are the other programs are more variable. The Idaho, the old Idaho program, which is now Lima Grain Idaho, had a lot of very good winter tolerance in it. And then the Oregon and the Lima Grain program based out of Waitsville are more variable.
You stated that we are having fewer frost days. Is there anything that farmers can do to take advantage of what is essentially a warmer climate?
This is more something that breeders are talking about. You know, what we're trying to do is keep the winter tolerance of Eltan, but move the photoperiod sensitivity down a little bit so the plants can start growing earlier in the spring when the temperatures are right, but they still are able to handle the real severe winters. We actually got a big project where we plant everything down in Oregon and go down and take pictures all winter and of the growth, and we're trying to figure out how we can separate that out. And we know that it can be separated because, for example, I mentioned Kansas and Colorado. They have very, very winter-tolerant varieties that respond to a shorter day-length photoperiod than ours do. So we know we can manipulate those two cues to get the responses that we want. So.
Okay. All right. So let's talk about vernalization. Now, this has always been a difficult one for me to grasp. How have we created wheat plants that need a long period of cold in order for them to set heads?
So wheat is what's called a winter annual. Winter wheat is a winter annual. Spring wheat is a spring annual. And winter annuals generally need a period of cold, and they also respond to photoperiod to flower to do this vegetative to reproductive switch. So there's a little bit of disagreement, but I think in general, people feel that evolutionarily, wheat was more of a winter annual than a spring annual, and that the spring habit was the kind of the mutant that was then selected to grow. But we also know wheat was selected over time to kind of match the latitudes where it was grown. If wheat originated in the Mediterranean, it didn't have to, across the Middle East over into Iran and Iraq, it didn't have to be very winter tolerant, you know. But then as people moved it into the Ukraine, they had to they just selected it for more winter tolerance. And then the people that kept growing wheat really in the Mediterranean itself, they could get by with what we would think of as spring wheat planted in the they often plant it in the winter. Like in California here, we plant spring wheat in November, but it's functionally spring wheat. It's just mm-hmm. grown all winter. So I think it happened over a long period of time, and people moving the wheat plants around and selecting what they needed.
Is vernalization, you know, a one gene kind of thing, or is it a highly complicated kind of thing?
There are vernalization genes that are important. Their regulation, they essentially act as repressors of the transition to flowering. Mm-hmm. So they need a certain period of cold in order to be turned off. So essentially, the way you can think of a repressor is a brake. So it's putting the brake on the transition from vegetative to reproductive growth. And these vernalization genes are conserved in many different plant species. Vern genes act as brakes. And, of course, wheat being a hexaploid means that there are more vernalization genes. And we know a fair amount about them and about conservation of the pathway in wheat. But again, it's more complex because of the hexaploid nature of bread wheat.
The breaks come off because of the warmth or the light or both?
They come off based on duration of cold. So as I told you, the plants are metabolically and active and are still signaling through the winter. And in order for that break to be released, it needs usually between 8 and 12 weeks of cold treatment
mm-hmm. for winter wheat.
Okay. So. All right. If you could order winter weather, what would be the perfect scenario for a wheat plant? How much snow would you order?
Like about, I'd like about 6 inches to a foot, but I want it to not get snow mold too, so I don't want it to hang around too long. You know, I think snow mold needs three months of winter, so we'd probably want 6 inches to a foot for 2 months, you know, or something like that.
And what about the dryness of the soil? I mean, you know, you might have 6 inches on the surface, but the profile might be parched. And isn't that a big part of it as well? I mean, don't you want the profile to have quite a bit of water in it, for instance?
Like this year, for example, It's pretty dry below the surface, you know, and some people have told me you go down 3 and 4 feet and it's still very, very dry, and that's not good. I mean, we need to have moisture throughout the profile at this time of year because we've got these plants, you know, growing and expecting that they're going to hit moisture as they grow larger, and then if we go into the spring as dry as we are, we're going to see it in the crop.
How have this season's conditions affected the wheat plants?
Well, you know, what happened this year is we had really good moisture all last year. So people who planted into stored moisture, I think the crop came up and it is doing relatively well. The problem is we didn't really get any moisture for most of the late summer and into the fall. It was very dry. And so people who are annual cropping, most of the people, including us, when we planted the breeding program, just dusted the wheat in at that point because it was getting later in October and we had to get it in the ground. Most of that is just coming up now. And there's not a lot of moisture in the soil profile on that wheat. And that wheat is at risk. I mean, there's no other way to say it. And we need to get some more rain and more snow. Snow would actually be better because the rain, if we get too much rain without a good crop cover, we're going to get a lot of erosion. And so if it would snow more, that would be good right now. White Christmas, that's what we want.
All right. So. How does one breed winter hardiness into plants? Is it just selection? I mean, you find something that's hardier and you breed with it or what?
Well, that was the way we always did it, you know. And then Brian Fowler up in Saskatchewan commented that the wheat breeders always managed to breed wheat that was just resistant to temperatures maybe 1 or 2 degrees colder than the average, you know, in all parts of the country. And so if you really want to breed more cold-tolerant wheat, I think in some ways you need to go to a cold place like Montana or Saskatchewan, North Dakota. They have the best cold tolerance. The problem with that is they have different diseases and things like that. So I just can't take all the wheat here and grow it all in Montana and have good wheat for the Pacific Northwest. So we've learned a lot about molecular markers now. We kind of know what to select, in that way. And then we do our artificial freezing tests to try and breed for more cold-tolerant wheat. And so we're always still just kind of trying to keep a little bit better than the prevailing average temperature. But.
Okay, so this is a podcast that's going to come out on Christmas Day. Is there anything else, any summation, anything that you can say about what an incredible plant this is as we go through the winter?
I think wheat's a great plant. I mean, we were looking through Facebook the other day. My kids, they have this thing where you can average out all the pictures you've taken, and mine were all of wheat, not of my kids. But anyway, it's really a resilient plant. You know, it's got the tillers, and so if part of it gets killed, sometimes another part can regrow. You know, the root system is pretty resilient. And it can take a lot of beating and still make it through. So I don't know what you have worked more on other kinds of plants. So
I've worked more on other plants and model plants, but we keep coming back to wheat because it's so fascinating. It's fascinating genetically, environmentally, the amount of diversity in the germplasm and kind of complexity in genome organization. It's, you know, you're always finding something surprising or new. Of course, we do a lot of molecular work, so we're trying to translate work that's been done in other crops or other systems to wheat. And there are just a lot of surprises and changes, and it's a very interesting plant developmentally, physiologically, and genetically.
You'd think after all this time and all this science that we would know everything there is to know about the wheat plant, but you're saying not by a long shot?
Oh, I think there's still so much we don't know about so many things, and I think it's the beauty of science and maybe job security for Kim and myself of, you know, you answer one question, you have 10 more. And so, you know, we try to work off hypotheses and what we think is going on, and it always ends up being a little bit more nuanced and complex. So one of the things we do in my crop physiology course is talk about plant intelligence. And, you know, the students are kind of all over the place, but we need new terminology to explain how complex and sophisticated plants are. Mm-hmm. They can't move. They can't put on a jacket. They can't, you know, so yeah. They really have to coordinate their efforts to respond to and acclimate to changing temperatures, changing day length, so many different cues.
I hope as you go about your activities during this beautiful holiday season that you think about the beauty of science. As Sanguinet put it, we know so much more about the wheat plant than Jasper Spillman, the first WSU wheat breeder, knew just 100 years ago. And yet there is still so much to discover. I hope you enjoyed part two of Dead of Winter, Alive with Life. Wheat plants in the cold. And will join me again next time for another episode of the Washington Grain Commission sponsored podcast, Wheat All About It.
We're all children of a special treat, a miracle of nature that we just call wheat. A crop that's in the Bible, a crop that's in our bread, a crop that's filled our bellies and held us in good stead. Through a history of starvation and times of want and woe, wheat has been our savior, our grub, our gruel, our dough. There's always lots of problems when we have enough to eat, but there's only one dilemma when there's not enough wheat. We feed you.